I'm still baffled. The Tippett thing has baffled me my entire life. I think everybody understands the motorcade stuff, you know, in the school book depository, but nobody has ever resolved the Tippett affair. And man, is it a freaking mess. This Tippett case is a mess of a riddle wrapped in an enigma inside of a nutshell. The Tippett thing, I mean, I've heard so many different theories about Tippett that, you know, the more I dig down, the crazier it gets.
The entire Kennedy assassination is a rabbit hole. But nowhere in this whole event is the rabbit hole deeper than in understanding the J.D. Tippett murder.
There's something with Tippett, I don't know what it is, and we may never know what it is with Tippett, but obviously he was in further than has been alleged by the Dallas police. He could have been killed by the Dallas police. He certainly wasn't killed by Oswald.
And then he went outside and the housekeeper saw him. While he was in the room, the police car pulled up and beeped its horn a couple times. And she said she saw two policemen in the car. And we don't know who they are exactly. Some people have speculated Tippett might have been one of them. And then Oswald is seen by her leaving the house and standing by a bus stop at the corner. And then that's the last sighting of him until a few minutes later, Butch Burroughs, who was the guy who sold the concessions at the Texas Theater in Oak Cliff, which was not too far from Oswald's rooming house, said he saw Oswald enter about 1:07. And the official story is that Oswald didn't enter the theater until about 1:45. The ticket seller, Julia Postal, claimed that he entered without buying a ticket, and he was captured about 1:52 in the theater. And so in between what happened, you know, if he's at the theater at 1:07, he couldn't have shot Tippett because the Tippett shooting probably took place at 1:08 or 1:09. Witness testimony reinforces that. Helen Markham, who was the star witness for the Warren Commission, who was a dubious witness, claimed that he was shot at 1:06. Other people think that could be true, but it's around that time. The Warren Commission tried to distort it, making it seem like he was shot as late as 1:15, which would have given Oswald time to walk from the rooming house. Part of the reason it's hard to believe that Oswald did it is, you know, if Oswald's outside his rooming house at 1:03, 1:04, he wouldn't have had time to walk the distance. I've walked that route several times, and it takes probably about 10 minutes to walk if you're not running. He wouldn't have had time to get there unless they pushed the time back. So the time is a very critical factor. I don't think Oswald shot Tippett. I think somebody else shot Tippett.
Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. On November 22, 1963, two men died in Dallas, Texas. One was President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. The other was a Dallas police officer named J.D. Tippett. While the world focused on JFK, the murder of Tippett quietly became the linchpin in the case against Lee Harvey Oswald. But was it really that simple? Over the past 7 episodes, we have peeled back the layers of testimony, timelines, and strange coincidences to ask the question, did Lee Harvey Oswald kill Officer J.D. Tippett, or was something else going on? Today, I will give you my conclusion. Now that we've reviewed the key details surrounding Officer J.D. Tippett's murder and Lee Harvey Oswald's arrest, it's time to synthesize the evidence and see what conclusions we can draw. To do that, we'll look at 3 things. Facts that support Oswald's guilt, facts that support his innocence, and then the facts about the case that don't fit either narrative. Let's begin with the first category, evidence pointing towards Oswald's guilt. First, you have the revolver. When Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested, he was carrying a revolver that matched the serial number of one ordered to the Oswald Hydell P.O. box in Dallas. Oswald admitted to owning the gun, but claimed he purchased it in May, an assertion that conflicts with the Warren Report's timeline. While the absence of proper paperwork cast a shadow over the transaction, dismissing the revolver as evidence requires believing that the FBI fabricated purchase records and planted a matching weapon. Regardless of the paperwork, Oswald had a loaded revolver on him when he was arrested. If he were entirely innocent, why carry a weapon at all? It is obvious that Oswald was fearing for his life, for one reason or another, and grabbed the revolver when he got back to his rooming house after the assassination. That question alone makes the revolver a compelling piece of evidence in the case against Lee Harvey Oswald. Second, we have the eyewitness testimony. The Warren Report claims 9 witnesses identified Lee Harvey Oswald as Tippit's killer. But a closer look reveals a more complicated picture. First, you have Domingo Benavidez, who was the closest witness. He never formally identified Lee Harvey Oswald as the killer of J.D. Tippit. William Scoggins, cab driver, had a partially obstructed view, but did see the shooter flee and later identified Lee Harvey Oswald in the lineup. Helen Markham, the star witness for the Warren Commission, also identified Lee Harvey Oswald as the killer of J.D. Tippit, though her account was vague and inconsistent. However, the lineups themselves were problematic. Oswald was visibly agitated and even stated his name and workplace at the Texas School Book Depository during the process. This was after it was publicly known that the shots had come from that location. So while the witness accounts are valuable for what they saw, the identifications are arguably tainted by suggestive procedures that seem designed to single out Oswald as the killer. Then we have the shell casings. The shells found at the scene of Tippit's murder matched the revolver Oswald was carrying. That's damning until you consider Officer Poe's claim that he marked the shells with his initials, which were not found on the shelves in the National Archive in evidence. This discrepancy opens the door to speculation about tampering or framing. But again, Oswald had 5 extra rounds in his pocket. If he were simply heading to a movie, that's a bizarre coincidence. The ammunition, like the revolver, adds weight to the case against Lee Harvey Oswald. Now what about the gray jacket? A light gray zipped-up jacket was found discarded near the scene by an unknown man and handed to Captain Westbrook. Marina Oswald confirmed Lee owned a similar jacket. However, she also noted that Lee never dry cleaned his clothes, and the jacket had a dry cleaning tag inside it. Additionally, Earlene Roberts reported that Oswald left the rooming house wearing a dark jacket that day. So while the jacket could link Oswald to the scene, the inconsistencies weaken its evidentiary value. Compared to the revolver, shells, and eyewitness accounts, it's the least persuasive, but still part of a troubling pattern. Now we look at some of the facts that support Oswald's innocence. As with any complex case, there's always more beneath the surface. Now let's examine the evidence that casts doubt on Lee Harvey Oswald's guilt in the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit. First, the timeline doesn't match up. The Warren Report suggests Oswald left his rooming house around 1 p.m. and shot J.D. Tippit at approximately 1:15 p.m. But multiple witnesses contradict the timeline. Oswald was seen waiting for a northbound bus at 1:04 p.m., even though Tippit's murder occurred south of this location. D.F. Bowley saw Tippit's body and checked his watch at 1:10 p.m. Margie Higgins heard gunshots and saw 1:06 on her clock. Helen Markham, which was a star witness for the Warren Commission, was en route to catch a 1:12 p.m. bus, placing the shooting at 1:06 to 1:07 p.m. Butch Burroughs at the Texas Theater claimed Oswald arrived at the theater between 1 and 1:07 and bought popcorn from him at 1:15 p.m. So how could Oswald have been at 2 places at the same time? If Oswald was at the theater by 1:07 and buying popcorn at 1:15, it's hard to reconcile that with him committing a murder blocks away at the same time. And the most damning evidence against the case of Lee Harvey Oswald being the killer of J.D. Tippit is the fact that Tippit was pronounced dead at Methodist Hospital by Dr. LaCourie at 1:15 p.m. Yes, he is pronounced dead at the hospital at 1:15 p.m. So there's no way the murder happened at 1:15 p.m. if he was already being pronounced dead at the hospital at that time. That puts the shooting of Tippit much earlier, like around 1:06 to 1:07 p.m. And if Oswald left his rooming house between 1 p.m. and 1:04 p.m., there is no way he could have covered that 0.9 mile distance on foot in time to kill Officer Tippit. Next, we look at the behavior of the shooter. It was illogical. Helen Markham testified that Tippit pulled up behind the man on the sidewalk, who then turned around and approached the patrol car, leaning into the window before firing. This wasn't a panicked escape. It was a deliberate confrontational act. If Oswald were trying to avoid police attention, why would he walk back toward an officer and initiate contact? The shooter's behavior suggests premeditation, not flight. Either Oswald was acting irrationally, or it wasn't him at all. So what about the fingerprints that don't match? Fingerprints found on Tippit's patrol car did not match Lee Harvey Oswald. If the shooter leaned into the window as Helen Markham described, we'd expect prints. However, another witness, Jack Tatum, claimed that the shooter kept his hands in his pocket. If Tatum was right, the absence of prints makes sense. If Markham is right, the mismatch is a problem if you want to stick to the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald killed J.D. Tippit. And what to make of the, quote, ruddy man? Multiple witnesses, including Calloway, Markham, Benavidez, and Julia Postal, described the shooter as having a ruddy or red complexion, which Oswald certainly did not have. This discrepancy suggests the possibility of a lookalike, especially given reports that someone resembling Oswald was arrested and taken out the back of the Texas Theater. Police reports from that day show that Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested in the balcony, but we know that's not true. The Lee Harvey Oswald that we all know was arrested on the first floor. But as you heard in the last episode, theater witness Al Pike did say that there was a Lee Harvey Oswald lookalike that was arrested in the balcony and took out the back of the theater. So what about the ballistics and the malfunctioning gun? The bullets recovered from Tippit's body couldn't be definitively matched to Oswald's revolver. The FBI claimed the gun had been rechambered, mangling the bullets beyond identification. Additionally, Officer McDonald, who arrested Oswald, said the gun clicked but didn't fire during their scuffle. He claimed the primer was dented. The FBI later disputed this, saying the revolver was functional. Still, the mismatch between bullets and weapon raises serious doubts. So what about the mystery of the brown shirt? Oswald was arrested wearing a brown button-up shirt, yet none of the Tippit witnesses mentioned seeing it. They described the shooter as wearing a white t-shirt under a zipped-up jacket. While it's possible the jacket obscured the shirt, it's odd that no one noticed it, especially given how many witnesses there were. Interestingly, Johnny Brewer and Julia Postal did describe the man entering the theater as wearing a brown shirt, adding another mystery to this timeline. So what about the radio reports? Johnny Brewer claimed he heard about Tippit shooting on the regular radio before Oswald arrived at the theater, just 8 blocks away. In 1963, it's questionable whether a news station could report a local shooting that quickly. If Brewer's account is accurate, it suggests the shooter couldn't have reached the theater before the report aired, casting doubt on Oswald's presence at the crime scene. So now let's look at some of the other facts in this case. The strange, the suspicious, and the unresolved. Not every detail in the Tippit case neatly supports Oswald's guilt or innocence. Some facts simply raise eyebrows, suggesting that something deeper may have been unfolding behind the scenes. These anomalies don't prove a conspiracy, but they certainly invite questions. One is Tippit's odd behavior before the shooting. In the 30 minutes leading up to his death, Officer J.D. Tippit's actions were anything but routine. He lied to the police dispatcher about his location while parked at the Glucco gas station, watching traffic coming from downtown. He then sped away hurriedly and was next seen urgently making a phone call at Top 10 Records. Shortly after, Tippett cut off insurance salesman James Andrews and searched the backseat of Andrews' car, clearly looking for someone. Tippett never said a word to Andrews and sped away. But here's the puzzle. The only suspect description broadcast at that time was a slender white male about 30 years old.
Attention all squad. The suspect in the shooting at Elm in Houston is reported to be an unknown white male, approximately 30, slender build, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight 165 pounds, reported to be armed with what is thought to be a 30 caliber rifle.
That's hardly enough to justify pulling someone over. So how did Tippett know who to look for? Was he acting on information not yet made public? If so, where did that information come from? Next, we have the honking police car at Oswald's rooming house. Earlene Roberts, Oswald's housekeeper, testified to the Warren Commission that a police car pulled up and honked outside Oswald's rooming house shortly before he left the rooming house. That detail is deeply strange. What are the odds that a police car would stop and honk at the exact location and time without any connection to the unfolding events? Some researchers suggest that this was Oswald's ride to the Texas Theater, implying coordination or surveillance. Was Oswald waiting for that car at the bus stop? Or was it just a bizarre coincidence? We will probably never know. So what about the wallet mystery? The wallet mystery is a fiasco, which remains one of the most confounding elements of the Tippett case. Marina Oswald testified that the wallet kept at the Payne house was more like a family bank, not the one Oswald carried daily. Yet there are conflicting accounts about where Oswald's wallet was actually found. Detective Bentley claimed it was discovered in the police car after Oswald's arrest. Captain Westbrook reportedly found a wallet that matched Oswald's wallet at the Tippett crime scene. Both wallets allegedly contained full identification for Lee Harsby Oswald and his alias, Alec Heidel. The idea that two identical wallets existed, each with incriminating ID, is hard to swallow. Either someone planted evidence, or the record of events is seriously flawed. These facts don't exonerate Oswald, nor do they prove his guilt, but they do suggest that the official narrative may be incomplete or manipulated. Tippett's erratic behavior, the unexplained police car, and the wallet confusion all point to a deeper mystery that still hasn't been fully unraveled. So what do we make of all this? The revolver, the eyewitnesses, the timeline, the fingerprints, the honking police car, the wallet? Each piece adds a layer to the mystery, but none of them tell the whole story. Whether you believe Oswald was guilty, innocent, or caught in something far more complex, one thing is clear. The Tippett case is not just a footnote in history. It's a doorway into a deeper question surrounding November 22, 1963. I remain unconvinced that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Officer J.D. Tippett. The record offers compelling clues, but it stops short of proof. We must acknowledge the possibility that Oswald did it. His revolver ties him to the scene, but the missing firearms paperwork leaves just enough uncertainty to sustain reasonable doubt. The eyewitness identifications lean against him, yet they were secured under deeply flawed conditions. Oswald stood out in those lineups, visibly agitated, even prompting to announce his workplace at the Texas School Book Depository. This is an objective testimony. It's a setup that practically pointed him out. I don't claim to know who pulled the trigger and killed J.D. Tippett, but I don't believe it was Lee Harvey Oswald, but an Oswald double that was used to frame the real Oswald for both killings that awful afternoon. We have more than enough evidence that someone was impersonating Oswald for weeks and months leading up to the assassination. Because of this, we have Oswald being in two places at the same time, more than a dozen times. The most important of these sightings were at the corner of 10th and Patton and inside the Texas Theater. The assailant of J.D. Tippett had to resemble Lee Harvey Oswald closely. Same build, similar features, but he had a ruddy complexion, one that Oswald did not have. That level of mimicry suggests more than a coincidence. It implies orchestration and planning, a frame job on a grand scale. Because if Oswald was innocent, someone went to extraordinary lengths to make him look guilty. And that raises a deeper question. Who stood to benefit from him being the lone suspect? Thanks for joining me on this journey through one of the most puzzling chapters in American criminal history. We'll see you next time. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com.